Hello and welcome to the AV Forums podcast for Monday the 16th of January. Warning, we are all suffering from jet lag. Well, at least three of us are. And joining me on this edition, our assistant editor Steve Withers.
You're doomed, you're all doomed.
News editor Mark Hodgkinson.
I'm a messenger of God. You're doomed if you stay here.
Audio reviewer Ed Selly.
Camp Crystal Lake is jinxed.
And special guest star Mark Botwright.
I don't love Ned.
So, welcome along to what's likely to be a long podcast, because we've got lots to get through from CES, and we also have the Nintendo Switch full details, as that press conference just happened a few hours ago at the time of recording this on Friday. So Mark's going to give us a full roundup of that. And then if we've still got time at the end of all that, we might do some movie news. So that's what you've got in front of you. Welcome back to the podcast. It is a new year. Happy New Year, everybody. And to start us off, we've got no current competitions and no previous competition winners, so we can move on swiftly to CES. And yes, it was a long week, still suffering at this end. I don't know about you, Steve or Ed.
I'm adjusted now, actually. Yeah. I think I'm okay. Yeah. We all need to eat more vegetables.
I'm fine. I think I'm going to go for a Five Guys for my lunch. Right, so CES roundup time. It was Ed's first time there, so I think Ed should go first on this one. So you were looking at Hi-Fi, but first of all, Ed, just tell everybody how big it is.
It's ridiculous. Essentially, you've got, to put it into perspective, you've got a dedicated Hi-Fi exhibiting area, which is the equivalent of the Marriott in Bristol. And you think, well, that's not so bad. Bristol show, get around that nice and easily. But you've then got additional bits that I was, you know, needed to take a look at, from headphone manufacturers and so on and so forth. And they were a fairly considerable distance away in different exhibition halls, and those exhibition halls then in turn contained, you know, everything else with a plug. And if you think that everything else with a plug had turned up, you begin to get sort of a sort of idea of the scale and scope of it. And then the other thing that makes it interesting, and I'm as guilty as the people I'm going to criticize here, is that if everyone just came out for their specific area of interest, so the kitchen goods people were in the kitchen goods hall or so on and so forth, that would be fine. But it doesn't work like that, because after a while the kitchen good people get bored and then start trying on the headphones that you're trying to do videos of. And in the same way, you know, I started, you know, laughing at the people with VR headsets on, presumably getting in the way of the people who actually wanted to report on VR headset. So you've got thousands of people there, and many of them aren't anywhere near where they're supposed to be. So it's vast and quite confused at the same time.
It's just getting around sometimes, which can be the major problem. It's something that we've learned over the years. Steve's been doing the show 6 years, Steve?
My seventh.
7 years, was it?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah, this is my seventh show.
Good for you. And obviously a decade for myself. And the show hasn't changed much in that time. It's just gotten bigger. And what used to be in the LVCC, the Convention Centre, which is probably, I'd say, maybe twice the size of the NEC in Birmingham. And then you've got all the hotels, so like the Venetian, and then there's other hotels, and there's other off show areas, depending on what it is you're covering, plus the two hotels that are on site. So you've got the Renaissance, and you've got the Westgate next door. It's just a massive area, and getting from one area to another is an absolute nightmare. I mean, we had a perfect example on the Friday morning. We met up with Vivitech. We were like 10 minutes late to turning up to that. Our next meeting was in the Westgate, which was a good 25-minute walk, and there's just no way we could make that meeting because it was so far away. So that gives you an idea. I mean, we could have walked over to that meeting. We then wouldn't be able to get back again until lunchtime to where we needed to be next, which was just too long. So it is a massive, massive area. So let's do the Hi-Fi news first then. Ed, what blew your frock up?
This is an answer in two parts, because I'll do the positive and good news first, and then I'll touch on my concerns. If you have some significant money to spend on audio equipment, you could argue that it doesn't matter what your interests are in terms of formats or type of amplifier you want, be it low powered valve or high powered solid state, your choice of truly astonishing equipment has never been better than it has right now. There is some truly incredible gear breaking cover, and quite a lot of it went to CES, and you develop a price blindness after a while. It's a bit like Munich. It's the same regard there. But my God, there was a short news piece that we put up about, and a video about, the new Sim Audio Moon power amplifier. Ignore all the headline stats and all the rest of it. You know, 800 watts is just, you know, just a number. Sitting and listening to them in a room which, you know, normally is supposed to have, you know, fat casino goers in it. It's not a dedicated sort of hi-fi enclosure. They were astonishingly good, and it was just one of a couple of amplifiers that were like that. And then, as I noted in the roundup video, I listened to a speaker with the somewhat peculiar name of the DeVore Fidelity Orangutan 96, and it might have a stupid name, but my God, what a thing.
Do you know why it's called the orangutan?
All the speakers have ape names. So there's a
Simian theme, isn't there?
Yeah, and the flagship's called the Silverback. So I guess the bloke just really likes apes. I'm not going to get... I don't want to actually think about that too hard. It just is what it is.
So there'll be one called the Clarkson, then?
Well, if he becomes aware of that rarest of the great apes, then yes, I dare say there might be. But as I say, all of the products that I'm talking about, the cheapest of the ones that I've just discussed was the Orangutan 96 at a mere $11,000. My concern is that outside of some of the British manufacturers who turned up, like Cord Electronics and Arcam, and off the headphone stands, where my worries are is that there's no content between equipment that people might buy to start out in hi-fi, be it either improving the playback of their digital files that they were initially listening to on their phone or computer, or they've bought a starter turntable. There's nothing that tells them or gives them any indication how they go from the starter equipment to this high end. There's just a big hole. If that's the message you took back from CES. Now, there are obviously some arguments here. It's a trade-only show. Space is limited. They can't bring everything. But it was like this worrying feeling that they're still just trying to sell more and more expensive equipment to an ever-declining circle of people. There wasn't the sort of mass market message that there was for you guys. And if CES was the only show of the year, it would be a genuine concern. It's not. There will be mass market messages later on in the year, so I'm not so concerned. But it felt extremely elitist.
I guess that's just the type of show that it is, Ed, and it's always been that way. I mean, even going back to Steve's first CES, I think we ventured into the Venetian, and within 5 or 10 minutes, we decided that we were going to go back to the lovely TV people, because as soon as you walked into any hi-fi room, you got stared at, and as if to say, "Well, you're a bit young. Why are you in here?"
Yeah. The other thing is, whilst I was taking photos of one piece of equipment, one bloke who his badge identified him as a dealer, based out of, now let me get this right, I think he was based out of Chicago, he referred to customers as civilians, as if selling high-end hi-fi equipment is some sort of insane war.
Yeah,
and it's like, you, sir, are a royal twat. And you know it wasn't, that in itself wasn't the most encouraging thing. Don't get me wrong, I'm still quite confident that the industry as a whole is actually in pretty good shape, because a number of people are learning some valuable lessons about how you bring new people into the game. But my God, they weren't that far in attendance at CES.
Yeah, it's we've always found that with the hi-fi side of things, it's definitely for the more established and like you say, the more well-heeled out there. There is that gap between the, because you've got Southall, which is more of the entry level area that you're talking about, so you know, budget turntables and headphones and headphone amplifiers and that kind of thing. That's very much Southall. As soon as you got the Venetian, yeah, you're talking big bucks, and it's another world compared to Southall. So apart from the orangutans, which sounds strange, what else really sort of, you know, inspired you?
The good news is that there are some affordable things, relatively affordable things. We stuck a new story up about it. The new Cord Electronics equipment, the Poly, which attaches to the Mojo DAC and essentially turns it into a compact and fully portable UPnP streamer and SD card based audio player. That looks very cool, and I can't wait to get my sticky mitts on that. Hugo 2, also from Cord, looks very encouraging, because not only does it do more than the original Hugo, Cord has clearly taken on board some of the feedback from customers and made it less weird. And that's, you know, that's a big deal for people that have known Cord for some length of time. Arcam just were doing a demonstration of what, you know, not cheap but still relatively sanely priced equipment can achieve, and you know what, it sounded fantastic. And then in terms of headphones, oh my word, there are some fantastic items breaking cover. The new Audio-Technica digital drive Bluetooth units, they're extremely clever, and I hope to get a pair of those in as soon as they land in the UK, because there's a hell of a lot of very interesting technology there. And it was one of the quieter little news stories. I did record a video, but unfortunately the sound was balked because I'm a rank amateur. Audizy, people who can't spell Audizy properly, they've released some planar magnetic earphones. Now they look a bit weird. It looks like you've basically swallowed a TIE fighter and they've popped back out of your ears, but they sounded absolutely sensational. Really very, very impressive sounding earphones. So in terms of portable audio and close and, you know, sort of self-contained listening, there was some really cool stuff breaking cover. And as I say, some brands have brought along some slightly more affordable items that, you know, hopefully we'll get a look at in, over the course of the year as they turn up.
And an affordable Technics turntable. Seemingly.
That as well. Yes, I'd forgotten all about that. Yes. Well, affordable. Again, all things are relative. I don't want to sound elitist here, because £2,000 for many people is a long way adrift of affordable. And we think it's going to cost £2,000. We don't know for absolutely sure. But that was actually quite encouraging, because if it does shave £1,000 off the SL1200G, the GR still looks and feels really very special indeed. So I'm hoping that the nice people at Panasonic/Technics will let us loose with one of those, and we can report back and we can see if the excitement is justified, because what I heard was very encouraging. But obviously we'll need to get it installed in here with some equipment that I'm familiar with, and we'll take it from there.
Okay, good stuff. And I guess to wrap up on your part, Ed, what about Vegas?
Vegas is a dump.
Okay.
it's Blackpool in the middle of the desert.
It is. It's for someone like myself who doesn't drink, doesn't smoke, and doesn't gamble, it has no appeal whatsoever. Although there are plenty of people who do love the place, and you know, it's set up for them because they're either gamblers, alcoholics, or
well,
you know,
I mean, look, I'm a high functioning alcoholic, and it was still, you know, I didn't think it was. It wouldn't be on my list of drinking cities. Not least because at $9 a beer in the casino, you'd need to be quite well off to achieve blindness. I will say, I don't want to have a total downer on the place. The moment that you're outside the city limits, the scenery is just eye popping. It's fabulous. I think you and I both would be quite content to spend a better portion of the week just wandering cheerfully around the desert, and then just pop in on the last day just to see what was there, and then just return to the wilderness. But yeah, that was, you know, that's by the by. It is what it is. It's, you know, I wasn't expecting it to be much different, if I'm completely honest. But I maintain, I mean, the saddest thing, as I've said in a couple of places, you could wander across the casino floors of any of the big ones, the Mirage, the Venetian, so on and so forth, and you could hand a $10 bill to everyone on the gaming floor that looked like they were enjoying themselves, and you'd still have change from 100 on the other side of the floor. No one actually looks like they're having fun. Well, except that bloke who'd handed over that large sum of money for that attractive blonde lady. He looked like he was going to have some fun.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's a unique place. It really is. And I agree with you. Once you're outside the city limits, it is. It's beautiful countryside out there. I absolutely love the desert. The Red Rock Canyon is a favourite. Me and Steve go every year. But
to point cameras at each other and shout. It was like a surrealist art installation. Yeah. I have taken a photo. It's on my Flickr. I'll stick it into the podcast thread. I just took a wide angle exposure of basically two men just pointing stuff at each other in the middle of the wilderness. It's fabulous.
Yeah. It is a bit surreal. Right, let's move on. Let's talk TVs, because that's usually the big story. And actually, Steve, there wasn't any major stories as such. It was more evolution rather than revolution, like we said in our wrap-up video, because apart from a few names that we knew who were going to launch OLED TVs, and a Dolby Vision announcement, there's not a hell of a lot else you can really point your finger at.
Yeah, it was a show of very few surprises. I mean, because like you say, Phil, we knew that Panasonic were going to launch an OLED TV, and it was fairly well rumored that Sony were going to do one as well. So they weren't really surprises to us. Maybe small surprises to other people, but I think that was well telegraphed. No great surprise there. So the one real surprise was Sony's, I suspect, very sudden and last-minute addition of Dolby Vision, which they'll be adding in the summer to any of their TVs that use the X1 Extreme processor, which is basically the ZD9 plus the new stuff coming out this year, the XC93 and the XC94. That was a bit of a surprise. Good news for Dolby, obviously. Having more than just LG supporting the format gives it much better traction in terms of becoming a mass market product. But otherwise, though, yeah, I mean, okay, OLED, plenty of OLEDs there. We've got Pani, Sony, and obviously LG. LG had a full range of products. They got five different OLED models, all exactly the same, I have to say, in terms of what's inside them. It's the same panel, same processing. The differences are all cosmetic, which actually is slightly different from last year. Last year, most of them were the same, but apparently the B6 used a different system on chip to the other three models. So there were minor differences there. But this year, they are exactly the same TV, but with cosmetic differences. So quite how they're going to look, we don't really know, because we only actually saw the E7 and the W7 at the show. They didn't have any of the other models on the show yet, so we haven't seen those, and so we don't really know what the cosmetic differences actually are. But in terms of picture quality, it looked amazing, didn't it, Phil? One of the big complaints we had last year about OLED was it did struggle with brightness. So when you're talking about the impact of HDR, although it could be very precise in terms of its delivery of those specular highlights, it couldn't quite hit the 1,000 nits peak brightness of some of the LCD TVs. They pushed the brightness a lot further now. I mean, LG were claiming they could hit 1,000 nits in vivid mode, which means it would be horribly inaccurate. Panasonic was saying that they could get to, with the same panel, could get to 800 nits accurately, which seems about right. So we're getting a lot closer to that 1,000 nit peak brightness target that a lot of contents actually mastered at. So in that sense, great news. We only saw demos and things on the show floor, but they certainly looked impressive. All three manufacturers looked impressive. And if you're looking at color accuracy, I would suggest that Pani will probably be the front leader there, given their history in that area. And that's the area they really concentrate on. So I should imagine that their OLED's going to be really accurate in terms of colors. Sony always deliver really good motion handling. A lot of my friends who are big fans of football, for example, they love the Sony TVs for watching football. So it'll be interesting to see how the OLED delivers in that sense. And obviously, LG stole the show with the W7, the wallpaper TV, which looked absolutely incredible. I mean, the idea of something that's 2 and 2.5 millimeters thick, you just stick to the wall with a magnet, is incredible. And obviously, it'll be interesting to see how they handle that for terms of review samples. I'm guessing it's probably not going to get sent out for review.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to be getting that one in for review. And interestingly, it's going to be interesting to see how that hits the retail chains and see what is in store for people who buy one of those, because I wouldn't want to set it up on my own and drop it and smash it, because it's going to be about £10,000 in cost. Yeah. So it's going to have to be professionally installed. So if you go and buy it from the likes of John Lewis or whoever, they're going to have to come and install that. So it's going to be interesting to see how they actually handle getting the W7 out into the market. And that's if it comes. LG have got previous for showing, high-end TVs like that, which don't actually really ever come to market. They might appear in Harrods, but that's about it.
That is very true. They do have a bit of form in that sense. What was interesting, I think, was obviously there was quite a lot of coverage and news about OLED, less so about LCD, LED LCD TVs. I mean, LG had a model on show, which actually looked pretty good, I've got to say, in the demos that we saw on the show floor. And obviously Samsung were pushing their LED LCDs, which they've slightly disingenuously now referred to as QLED, which looks an awful lot like OLED when you saw the actual logo they were using. I think for me personally, the biggest disappointment for the show was Samson. I think Samson really didn't have anything new. I mean, they were okay, a little bit brighter, a little bit wider color gamut. They were pushing the whole color volume thing because that's the one area where LED LCD still has a slight advantage over OLED. But I just felt like they were treading water. There was nothing new there. It was all just refinements of existing technology. They were still flogging LCD. I was hoping that they were going to come up with something a lot more revolutionary than that. I mean, if they're going to call something QLED, bring out something new. And what I was thinking was hopefully something that would involve using tiny little LEDs for each pixel, a la Crystal LED, which Sony were showing at the show. But obviously, it's a big, huge, professional panel. It's not aimed at the consumer. It did look bloody good, though, I have to say. So Samsung were a bit of a disappointment for me, I have to say, at the show. I really hope they got something up their sleeve for next year, because I mean, they can't keep on just bringing out the same stuff over and over again.
Yeah.
And also being disingenuous in their naming, because this is the company, of course, that called an LED LCD TV LED TV to make it seem like it was something new, which it wasn't really. I know we all call them that now because it's kind of the shorthand, but calling it QLED just feels like come on guys, that's a bit
I mean, to be fair to Samsung, the TVs that they are releasing are very, very nice TVs. The design's really nice, and the technology on board is proven technology, Steve. We've always liked their stuff when we've had it in for review. So I guess really all we're saying is that in terms of where they're going next, they didn't really show their hand.
No, not at all.
And it's going to be interesting to see where they go, because I think there's bigger problems for Samsung to deal with other than their TVs at the moment. That was really obvious getting onto the planes this year with big signs telling you, you know, if you had a Galaxy S7, you were not getting on the plane. It was a prohibited item now. So they've got bigger fish to fry, I think, than their TV division at the minute.
In fairness, they did confront that absolutely head on. It was the very first thing that the CEO spoke about in the press conference.
Yeah, totally. And I was just highlighting that's maybe why there's not the budget or dollars being spent on developing TV at the minute, because they have bigger problems that they need to deal with. And it also may be the wrong time in the product cycle, Steve. I think they maybe are working on something else. It's just CES came along before they were ready to show it. That may also be the case. It has been the case in the past with other manufacturers. So it could just be that they've just had an off show.
One good bit of news, though, is that they're going to call them all the same model numbers worldwide for a nice change, which makes our life a lot easier.
Thank God for that. The amount of time that's spent on YouTube correcting people who are saying that's not the 9,000, well, yes, it is in the UK, that is the 9,000. The other thing I will say is of a real lack of proper content on the show floor. Now, a lot of the time, you know, it will be generic footage that they have manufacturers have put together to show off their TVs, but every now and again, you know, you'll get TVs on the show floor that are showing genuine film content and so on. Just to give you an idea, and I can only remember the Sony stand where that was the case. A lot of the TVs were showing all generic stuff and not any genuine content. So I can only think of Passengers and The Shallows being shown on the Sony stand.
Of course, both of which were Sony Pictures, so I guess that's how they were showing that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, when you read these reports that are on other websites where they're saying that they're hands-on with something and, you know, reviewing these products on the show floor, take that with a huge pinch of salt, people.
Yeah. They won't even have the sound on for a start.
Yeah. Don't read anything into that. And when we say they looked all right, that's with generic content, and we're not going to give you an in-depth discussion on the picture quality, because it's impossible to do that on a show floor. And everything there is set up to look dazzling and to get your attention as well, because it's a new shiny product. So if you do read these hands-on and all the rest of them, take them with a huge, huge, huge pinch of salt. Anything that's mentioned about picture quality is not going to be accurate at all. And we know why the other websites do that. It's to gain some traffic on the model numbers and so on. But it's getting a bit silly now, Steve, isn't it? When you're reading stuff and you're thinking, well, they've just seen the same thing that we have, and there's no way that we would put our opinion to paper.
Yeah, it's I think it's slightly, again, disingenuous of the certain reviewers to say these are first looks or, you know, reviews or anything like that, when all they've done is seen a TV sitting on the show floor showing content selected by the manufacturer to make their TV look as good as possible. Sound's not up, they haven't seen the menu system, they haven't touched the remote control. You know, one of the big features of the Sony OLED, for example, is the fact that it, and this is really clever, I've got to say, is it uses the screen as a speaker, basically. That's fascinating. We haven't heard it in action yet. We've got no idea. It sounds really good.
Exactly.
But it certainly looks clever.
Yeah.
Design-wise...
So wait. Hang on a second. With the... So this is the equivalent. When I was in the Cord Electronics room and I got a look ahead of time, I had a 30-second listen to the content that was on the Poly at the time. And I could, based on what's going on here, I could have legitimately claimed that was a first listen, even though yes. I had no understanding of what the content was, and I listened to it for no more than, I think, if I'm being generous, a minute.
Yep.
Fantastic.
Yeah. You wouldn't put your name to that, would you?
Well, no, because it would be completely and utterly irrelevant.
Exactly. This is what we're saying. It's getting really, really silly now. And it's a lot of them are major sites as well, which you would think there would be... Yeah,
more circumspect.
Exactly. Yeah, it is getting a bit silly now. Anyway, Steve, what are you saying?
Oh, sorry, I was just saying that in terms of some of the things that we saw that did catch my attention TV wise, like I say, the Sony's sound system certainly sounds interesting, no pun intended. In terms of the way it delivers the sound using the screen, that's fascinating.
It would have been nice to actually hear that, and I'm not sure
sound
if
demo. Yeah,
I'm not sure if they had an off-floor demo area or somewhere on their stand that we maybe missed as we're going around, because it's difficult to find the demo rooms and so on. But it didn't appear that there were any demos of that, which is a shame, because that's something I really would have liked to have listened to.
Yeah, I have to be honest. This has me looking at OLEDs from a less technically expert and sort of just a wider sense. This to me strikes me as a bit clever, because it is it's a utilization of the panel which does have some huge cosmetic and aesthetic benefits going forward. I mean, essentially, you can sell monitors or things that look like monitors that are also able to generate sound as and when required. And I'm sure it's probably technically possible to try and to do the same with an LCD or QLED panel, but I'd be surprised if it was in any way, shape or form remotely effective. This, I'm not suggesting for a second that this initial offering, you know, is going to change the world, especially as there's only one, you know, one model from one company, but I like this. This is, to my mind, this is at least as innovative as making the television really, really thin and sticking it to the wall with magnets. This is quite clever stuff.
Yeah.
And for a consumer base that, you know, they're going to be aware of, you know, brightness and you know, the increase in color and so on and so forth. But simply saying to them, well, actually, this one doesn't necessarily need a soundbar. You know, it just will sit there with very little in the way of additional material around the actual display itself, and still produce sound. That's like, ooh, where do I sign? I think that's very cool, and it's quite nice to see that it was Sony that decided to do that.
Yeah, and it's got to be said as well that Panasonic and Sony have clearly spent time developing their OLED TVs so that they're not just rehashes of what LG have done. They've actually put some thought into the design and so on. So Sony TV sits on the flat surface because it doesn't need the soundbar, because it has the sound actuators. It can sit on the desktop or on top of your TV stand. It's got toughened glass on the bottom to make sure you don't get any damage, and it harks back to their monolith design from a few years ago, Steve, in terms of that it leans back slightly on the stand, and obviously the subwoofer is built into the stand that goes from the back of the panel onto the surface. And then Panasonic, they actually use the soundbar as the actual stand, so the soundbar is the same width as the TV, and then you have a central area where it lifts the panel up, and then it goes down as a foot at the rear of it. And again, it's a different approach to just a black square rectangle.
Yeah, I'm not totally in love with the whole being at a slight angle on the Sony OLED, although you can always wall mount it, which is the option, alternative option. But in terms of the Panasonic OLED, well, I did like, and this is something I think a lot of people probably would like, is you can wall mount it, and you don't have to use the soundbar if you don't want to. So if you've got, you know, an AVR and a 5.1 or 7.1 system or an Atmos system, whatever it is, you can just use the TV effectively as a monitor, which I think a lot of AV Forums members are always asking about, because obviously being, you know, AV enthusiasts, they'll probably have some sort of outboard sound solution anyway. So really the built-in sound system on a TV is irrelevant. And so the option of doing that actually, I mean, is actually quite useful. Otherwise, though, yeah, you're right, Phil. They obviously spent a lot of time trying to print their own stamp on an OLED TV, because obviously we all know they're LG display panels, regardless of which manufacturer it is. So, I mean, they're trying to give their own little stamp of, their brand on that particular OLED. And I think they've both succeeded, both Panasonic and Sony have succeeded in terms of doing that, creating TVs that are distinct from LG's models, while still obviously offering the advantages of OLED. So that was good. In terms of Samsung, they did bring out, I mean, while I was saying they're a bit disappointing in terms of anything new in terms of technology, in terms of refinements, though, they did have some really nice features on their TVs. So, for example, as with previous generations, they use the One Connect box, which I think is a really good idea. I don't understand why more people don't do it. But now that's connected to the panel by a tiny, tiny, thin fiber optic cable, which means you can really hide it away very easily, and just have the screen mounted on the wall, and there'll be nothing going to the to the TV apart from this tiny fiber optic cable, obviously the power cable too. But, I mean, it makes for really, really nice installation options for people doing home installations.
Yeah, and lazy people like me who are absolutely hopeless at DIY, but at least you can, you'd have to go channeling through the walls and plastering over it and so on.
No.
I quite like that. Yeah, that appeals to me. So that's the TV side of things. Now, we are going to get updates on this, so stay tuned to the podcast in the coming weeks, because we have, beginning of February, Sony's trade, UK trade show, which is where they will reveal all their models for this year in the UK, so the UK spec models. So we'll have full details of that, and I'm assuming that is not going to be under NDA. So we should be able to talk about that once that event happens, which is a Thursday. So we should be able to talk about that on the podcast on the following Friday. And then we have Panasonic's European convention, which has been held in Frankfurt. Again, myself and Steve are heading out to that, and that's going to be, is it the 15th and 16th of February? I believe that's the right date. So again, we'll be back on the podcast on the Friday to talk about what was shown there. And stay tuned for that, because there's going to be some interesting announcements, I think, in terms of TV there. So there will be some news that we can't talk about at the minute, but stay tuned. It should be interesting. So that's the TV roundup. And in terms of projectors, there wasn't an awful lot to look at, Steve, but it's never been a projector show. CES in the States, it's always the CEDIA show, which is round about September, and in Europe it's round about September again for IFA, where we get the major projector news. However, JVC are launching their latest X series of projectors, which are, again, it's evolution, not revolution. They're basically adding HDR metadata functionality. So
detection,
it will automatically go into HDR mode, not like at the moment where you have to manually switch things. And there's a slight increase in the bulb output, and that's about it.
And a low input lag for gaming.
Low input lag for gaming. So, it's a welcome upgrade, but that's all it is. It's an upgrade. It won't be running on 4K chips, but that's not going to happen for at least another couple of years with JVC, because that's why they have the Z1 on the marketplace, because that's their 4K projector, and it will be for the next 2 years as that technology then moves down the line and should then hit the top of the range consumer products, I would say, in the next 18 months to 2 years. So it's going to take a little while for that. In terms of 4K, we actually saw the Vivitec projector, Steve, a DLP. Again, it's not a 4K chip. It actually uses clever technology. It's not quite e-shift. It doesn't shift the image. It basically flashes the image. So a little bit like, I guess the easiest way to explain it would be a little bit like the old Interlace system.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's not a native 4K panel, the chip, but it sort of basically flashes half the image and then the other half the image, because of the incredibly fast response times of DLP. It can show you the full 8 million pixels as far as your eye is concerned simultaneously. So you get the 4K image that way. So it definitely works, doesn't it, Phil? We were looking at some, I mean, this was a prototype. It wasn't the finished projector yet. They were still working on it, but they were showing some footage from, I think it was from the Euros from last year, shot in 4K, and it looked impressive. It looked, certainly looked like a 4K image to me, so you see the increased resolution there and all the details. So it definitely works. It'll be interesting to see what the actual final product looks like when it comes in for review. But certainly, what's important is I think we're still going to start seeing these DLP 4K projectors coming in at a much more attractive price point compared to a market that's currently dominated by Sony, of course, and where the cheapest is the 350. Is it 350 now? We're on to
320. They haven't replaced it.
Oh no, they didn't replace it. So it's a 320, which is what, $5,000, I think. So they'll be below that point, well below that price point, I suspect. I know that some manufacturers are talking below $3,000, so a lot cheaper in terms of entering that marketplace. Obviously, the TV will support HDR as well. A lot of the other factors, a lot of the other features, like things like HLG and that kind of stuff, they weren't sure about because, as I said, it is a prototype; it's still in development. One interesting thing, though, it hasn't definitely not got 3D. So it's interesting that even the projector manufacturers are starting to ditch 3D as a feature, whereas before they'd retained it.
That's a bit of a shame when you think of it. It's a DLP projector, so you know triple flash technology exists. A lot of the DLP projectors do extremely good 3D, and that's where 3D should be. It should be on a 100-inch and higher screen to get that immersive feeling from it. So it's a shame if they're going to drop it from projectors, because I think that's the one strong point and one strong area of the market for 3D is projectors, and definitely DLP projectors like the Vivitech. In terms of image quality, I will agree with you, it looks really good, and it looked really good on a show floor where there was lots of ambient light hitting that screen, and it was still really watchable. Another strength of that model is going to be, you know, use in rooms with light coloured walls and ceilings, because it really did stand up quite well. Although it was using a light rejection screen, I still think that combination works really, really well.
Yeah, definitely. Like you say, they were the first to admit they weren't ideal conditions for projection, but it delivered a very watchable picture, even though there was an awful lot of ambient light in that room. So, look, that'd be interesting. And obviously, they're not the only DLP manufacturer that are lining up 4K, because Optoma also have a model lined up. I'm sure BenQ will be joining the marketplace soon as well. So there are going to be at least three manufacturers there with more attractively priced 4K potential HDR projectors. So that's good news for the market, isn't it, really, for projector fans out there?
I guess we need to call them 4K capable projectors and not 4K projectors, because they are not native. And I think people need to understand that it's not native resolution chip. Anyway, let's move on. That CES covered, so there was some interesting gaming news that is breaking today as we record this podcast. So by Monday it'll be old news, but never mind. We'll go over to Mr. Botwright, who has a full report for us.
Yes. Kudos to anyone who got up at 4 a.m. to watch the presentation. I didn't. I just got up a little bit earlier to watch it before we started this. it's one of those things. You always know that they're going to start late, and no one wants to kind of be waiting around for kind of 40 minutes before something starts with like a kind of industrial light show playing in the background. It seems like we've got all the details that we really need. We're only now, we're under a couple of months away from release. March 3rd, simultaneous worldwide release date, and we've got the price. They got that out of the way nice and quickly, which usually tells you that it's going to be a slightly bitter pill to swallow. If someone waits right till the end before telling you the price, it's usually fairly good. 29,980 yen, then $299.99, and they said check with local retailers in Europe for price, and it looks like it's going to be about 280 for British punters. And again, if you've managed to jump on one of those pre-order deals with certain online retailers, were gambling on the fact that it would be £200, so they were asking £199, and with a price promise that they wouldn't charge you any more, then you know you've done exceptionally well there. I quickly looked online this morning and saw that, shock horror, everyone stopped taking pre-orders at that price. Yeah, they're pushing it as more of a new idea, like a combination of their existing models of, you know, home console and handheld, rather than a bit of a retreat from dedicated home consoles. They had to keep on repeating the term home console to kind of emphasize that fact, because that high price point does look it looks extreme for anyone who's going to be viewing it as a handheld with a TV out. So they have to kind of push this idea that it is different from that. Got a little bit of detail about the battery. It's going to range from 2.5 hours to 6.5 hours. Now, you're going to assume that 6.5 hours is, you know, absolute optimum brightness down to zero, or as close as you can get to it with the least demanding game, and, you know, everything turned off. For a demanding game to only get 2.5 hours, it's not great. However, it'll do for the people who are considering as something for a commute, if they want to take their game and this idea that you can instantly switch from home console playing your Zelda or whatever, picking it up and heading out the door and being able to carry on with that game, then I think 2.5 hours it's serviceable.
It does have a USB out, doesn't it? Like a standard USB out, so you could be able to use it with a USB power pack or whatever. Like, that's a bit of a redeeming feature.
Yeah, USB Type-C. It was kind of half shown in the teaser. They showed a lad kind of sitting, I think it was at the airport, and he was playing, and the, you know, eagle-eyed viewers spotted that there was a kind of a lead dangling out, which I think everyone naturally assumed that it would be absolute insanity to only allow it to charge from the dock. Other than that, they've kind of pushed with a few of modern gaming's de facto features. Online subscription service now, it seems like there'll be a free trial up to autumn. But then also word about using smart devices to link up with friends for things like invites, and I don't know whether that's going to include voice chat, whether they're going to try and push that as a separate thing. You know, it seems slightly strange. People have always been hesitant to kind of use smart devices as an extra thing to add to their kind of console gaming. People don't like it if there are features kind of hidden away they have to get another device out for, particularly considering when it's just a standard now of kind of modern gaming. Everything is there in one box. Other than that, it was a fairly conservative affair. Really, it's the games that are going to sell it. They showed one called Arms, which is a boxing game, which is very much Splatoon-like for Nintendo, to kind of their version of combative multiplayer gaming, but using motion control. 1-2 Switch, which seems almost like their kind of Switch version of Wii Sports, a kind of proof of concept, more of a party game to sell the idea of the Joy-Con and two-player. That's had an interesting feature in as much as you're not directly facing the screen. You would be two people facing each other. They showed it off with things like having a gunfight and that kind of thing. But I'm a little bit dubious about that, simply because surely it's going to wholly rely upon the accelerometer and the gyro in the Joy-Cons themselves, which can only get you a certain degree of accuracy. And now that we're kind of moving towards VR, and if you don't have a camera tracking movement, you know, it's going to be still quite sketchy in comparison to things on other consoles now. Other than that, I guess the big takeaway from the show would be Zelda Breath of the Wild, which had been rumored to be delayed until kind of more autumn time, and everyone was expecting a Mario title for launch. It looks like Zelda's back on for March the 3rd for launch, and it's Super Mario Odyssey, the new 3D Mario game. Looks much more in line with Mario 64, based more around kind of exploration and sandbox adventure, but that's just penciled in as, in quotes, holiday 2017. So
that could be anything.
How do they know when I'm going on holiday?
I'm going to Skegness in March. Please have it ready by then.
What happens if you're not going on holiday?
You can't have the game then, can you?
It'll be waiting for you at duty free.
Yeah, I must say, I was underwhelmed by it all, particularly the price, because the rumours, as the retailers thought, were $199. They'd expect them to get that right, and I would have been in on day one on with that, but not at $280. It's just too much.
No, that's the thing, and it's a very strange price point, considering that everyone has been pretty much touting this as the one which shows Nintendo have kind of learnt from the failures of the Wii U, which launched at too high a price point, mid-generation, and was seen as weak in comparison to the competition. Now, bear in mind that recently we've had decent deals when certain online retailers were getting rid of old stock of PS4s. You could pick them up for about £150. You know, it's at kind of at close when you're up towards £300, you know, you're pushing over that with a game, you're kind of heading towards territory where people are saying, well, I can get better bundles for PS4 or an Xbox One and over £300, then you're in kind of PlayStation 4 Pro territory.
Plus Scorpio's coming out, of course, next Christmas, isn't it? So it'll be up against that in the holiday season.
Exactly. So. I mean, it's not going to be like a direct competition because obviously they're trying to tailor it to a slightly different market. But then when you look at the games that are coming out and they still have to kind of rely on wheeling out Bethesda to kind of keep milking the Skyrim cow and say, we've got this on another console and we've got FIFA again. And it's largely titles that people expected. I don't think there was any great surprises there. And when you look at launch day, unless I'm missing something, the last report I saw said Zelda, 1-2 Switch, Just Dance, and I think a Skylanders title on launch day. Now, for this
plus
big
peripherals are expensive, aren't they? Did you see the price of the Pro Controller?
No, I didn't.
Which you would want, presumably, if you're going to play FIFA, you wouldn't want to play it on the Joy-Cons. I think they were $70 in the US. So what's that, £60, £58 or something like that? Ridiculously expensive.
No, it is, and it's the funny thing is, the one thing that I've yet to really be sold on, and I guess this is something you can only really tell with a kind of hands-on, is still the kind of position or the comfort of the controllers themselves. You know, they're selling so much on this idea of using the Joy-Cons, and they've got these tiny little bumper buttons for if you're going to use it for like local multiplayer with setting up as a little tablet and that kind of thing. It looks slightly strange, you know. It's got this asymmetrical stick layout, but then they put the buttons directly above the right thumbstick, which if you think of any controller like the Xbox 360 controller being the obvious example with asymmetrical layout, they tend to be offset slightly. It just looks a little bit unwieldy.
It looks big, and it'll look big in the hand. In a child's hand, that's going to be hard, I would think. Just looking at it and looking at the photos of obviously a grown-up's hand in the promo shots, it looks large, really large. But we'll see.
Yeah, but they've said there's hands-on events for the press now, and for the public, they said in quotes, in the coming months. Now, bear in mind, it's under 2 months till it launches. I'm not exactly sure how that's going to get people kind of drawn in to be playing it. They need it kind of in shops within, you know, a few weeks in that run up to launch. I think it, particularly at that price point, it's gone from at $199. I think that's an impulse buy. I think they sell that to people, just, you know, anyone who's a lapsed Nintendo gamer or anyone like me. You bought a Wii U, you continue buying Nintendo consoles at $199. It's a kind of no brainer because it presents itself just as a powerful handheld at that price, you know. And then you go to $249, well, it becomes kind of borderline, but I think a lot of people assumed it wouldn't be over £250 if they wanted to really push it hard, if they wanted to make sure. As soon as you go over £250, the launch lineup has to be kind of more than that. It has to be more than people who just either want to play Zelda or a party game. It can't just be that.
What's the price like in Europe? Is it the same as the UK, or are we seeing a bit of Brexit in here?
I've not seen what the price is in euros, to be honest. But usually we get the short end of the deal on that one.
Is it a reflection of the yen as well? I don't know. I don't follow the international money markets, but is the yen particularly what it would be weak?
Well, we tend to get
strong, even.
Yeah, we tend to get. I think. You tend to look at the US price point, and then you take kind of, if it's $299, you tend to assume it'll be $249 in the UK. You get a bit knocked off. You're assuming kind of, you know, £30-40 at least. I'm a little bit shocked by the price, but on the plus side, it does come two SKU. You know, I think a lot of people were expecting a deluxe and a standard unit. Well, one of them comes with coloured Joy-Cons, so, you know, snap them up now.
What do you call the bit where the two Joy-Cons connect so it makes it a tablet? What's the middle bit called?
That's just the Switch.
All right. I would assume. You'd have thought they would have been clever and called that the Joy Division.
Very good.
I kind of claim that as my own. I did a Withers there. I copied somebody else's joke.
At least you admit it.
all original material when it comes to me.
Yeah, just not his original material. Right, so thanks very much for that, Mark. We'll keep an eye on the Nintendo Switch. And like you say, there's events and stuff coming up soon, so we might get some more feedback from that. So moving things on, that's the hardware news. We're going to go to movie news next. Okay, so moving to movie news, and we have to start on a sad note, because we finally got rid of 2016, but not before we lost someone who we just didn't think we were going to lose last year, and that was Carrie Fisher, Princess Leia to everybody on this podcast who grew up with a trilogy, and then tragically the day after her mother died as well. So a real shocker, that one, Steve. We didn't see it coming, it just happened over the weekend. I think she fell ill on a plane and never recovered.
Yes, it was a big surprise. Obviously, she had a heart attack while on a flight back to LA for Christmas. She was only, well, she's 60. That's really young, to lose someone. And it was a real shock. I mean, 2016 was not a great year for celebrity deaths, obviously. But losing Carrie Fisher, particularly when, you know, she just, previous year, she'd obviously done The Force Awakens. So she was sort of rejoining the Star Wars universe after a long break, and had shot her part for Episode 8 during 2016, and I'm assuming she was going to be Episode 9 as well. I mean, that seemed to be the intention. So that's a terrible loss for many reasons, not just sad that she died, but also that we should lose Princess Leia whilst we're in the middle of a new trilogy of Star Wars films. And then obviously the shock of her death causing Debbie Reynolds, her mother, to die the day after is doubly sad. I mean, terrible for her poor brother who's lost his sister and his mum in the space of one day, basically. That's really sad. So, yeah, it was. I mean, I think for a generation of fans, all of us here, particularly, you know, those of us who grew up with the original trilogy as children, you know, Carrie Fisher will always be Princess Leia to us, and that's sad. But she was a incredibly talented woman. Let's not forget, she was also a very skilled writer. Wrote some extremely funny and brutally honest autobiographies, as well as working as a script doctor in Hollywood. She doctored a lot of scripts and delivered some really good. She was a very, very funny, very witty person. I mean, she'll be missed. She'll be greatly missed.
I saw her on. Was it the Graham Norton show recently? Yeah, she still had all the marbles. She was sharp as a tack, and yeah, a very admirable woman. And yeah, it touched me quite a lot, that one did. I mean, a lot of the celebrity deaths did, but more so than anything, I think. And it just rounded the year off on a very bad note.
Yeah, I think it's a shock value that just not expected. Same with Bowie, you know, when we landed last year, Steve, from CES, that hit us like a rock, basically. Just not expecting that. And there was a few of those through the last year.
Well, I'm just going to say, in terms of remembering Carrie Fisher, you can keep your metal bikinis. Carrie Fisher was never more beautiful than wearing an enormous 80s cardigan in the Blues Brothers. that for me, in some ways, I don't know whether it's just cardigans and guns that trigger some unpleasant part of my brain, but that in so many ways, more perhaps than Princess Leia, there was more elements of Carrie Fisher being Carrie Fisher in that, and I will always treasure that film for many reasons, but that's a particular one for me.
And of course, there's a documentary, funnily enough, was being made and just finished before we lost both Debbie Reynolds and Carrie Fisher.
Yeah, somewhat ironically, Netflix, I believe it's Netflix, are working on a documentary. Carrie Fisher basically instigated it. She said, you know, Mum's getting old, which she was, and you know, this will be an opportunity now for us to do something about our relationship as mother and daughter. So they did this documentary together, which they just finished. And very sadly, of course, both then subsequently died. So a very timely documentary. I mean, I guess there's no good news out of this, but from a Netflix perspective, it's such a thing as bad advertising, I guess. They've got a documentary about Debbie Reynolds and Carrie Fisher to come out, which I'm sure we'll all watch. I'm sure it'll be very interesting, because Debbie Reynolds is a genuine Hollywood legend. I mean, she's been around, you know, since the 50s, so she's proper old school Hollywood, so her stories are always interesting, and obviously Carrie Fisher growing up in that life.
And talking about beauty, you just see her in Singing in the Rain. Stunning.
And talented too. You know, I mean, Gene Kelly, a harsh taskmaster, and you had to get everything perfect in a Gene Kelly movie, and she delivers the goods. At the age of, how old was she then? She was only like 20 19, or something. She was very 19. Yeah. So she was 19 in Singing in the Rain, and Carrie was 19 in Star Wars. So both of them started young, and got, and you know, okay, Carrie Fisher did die a little bit young at 60, but made it through the Hollywood ringer to a certain degree. It can never be easy. Certainly Carrie Fisher had a tough time after the success of Star Wars. If anyone wants a really good laugh and to see how funny she can be, watch The Roast of George Lucas, where she is absolutely brilliant in that.
Yeah, spot on. Okay, so moving things on very swiftly, because we are fast running out of time on this week's podcast, thanks to CES. Films opening this Friday, Steve, and like I say, briefly.
Yeah, briefly, we got Triple X, The Return of Xander Cage, for those of you who can remember, and God, it was a long time ago, there was a Triple X movie with Vin Diesel, which I hated. This looks like more of the same cobblers, extreme sports twats doing stupid things, pretending to be spies. I literally couldn't care less about this film. I can't begin to tell you how much I hate it.
It's an Ultra HD Blu-ray, though.
I know. It's going to be the final irony, isn't it? I have to buy the bastard. Split is coming out on Friday as well. Now, this does look interesting. This is M. Night Shyamalan Ding Dong, and he's pissed away his career in terms of big studio films, and has been making lots of little budget stuff because basically no one will hire him anymore. This is one of his low budget features. It stars James McAvoy as a person with split personalities. Apparently it's very good. Really worth checking out. This does sound interesting. James McAvoy is an actor I've got a lot of time for, and having watched the trailer, I certainly seems interesting. I don't want to give too much away, I don't want to say anything about it really, but it's been getting good reviews. A bit of a return to form for M. Night Shyamalan, Shyamalan, whatever his name is. This is the one that interests me out of the two that are coming out this Friday.
Okay, and again, briefly, Blu-rays.
Briefly, we've got on Blu-ray, we've got Ben-Hur, the remake of the remake, which did not get good reviews and didn't do very well at the box office. And it's only 2 hours long, so it's half the length of the one with Charlton Heston. We've got Don't Breathe, which does look very interesting. This is about a group of kids break into a blind guy's house to rob him and get a lot more than they bargained for. That's had very good reviews. That's a film I'm very interested in seeing. Anthropoid is a film set during World War II, true story. It looks interesting, certainly. It's a story I wasn't familiar with, so that might be worth checking out. It's got Cillian Murphy in it. Kubo and the Two Strings, I've seen. It's a stop-motion animated feature by Leica Studios, who made things like Coraline and Paranorman and also Box Trolls, and it's absolutely stunning. If you buy one disc and buy this disc, it's absolutely beautiful. If you've still got a 3D TV or 3D projector, it's also really good in 3D. And also we've got Hunt for the Wilder People, which is a New Zealand film with Sam Neill that's also been getting really good reviews, and it's supposed to be excellent. So of this week's releases, there's a good four or five films in there that are worth checking out. Probably not Ben-Hur so much, but personally I definitely recommend Kubo and the Two Strings, which I have seen, but I'm very keen to watch Don't Breathe as well.
Okay, and UHD Blu-rays, apart from buying them all when you were in the States, what's the news?
That was tragic to
watch. It was really, wasn't it?
You know, because especially just, I know we're tight for time, but I need to stress this. We were stood in front of the 4K Blu-ray selection, and actually, do you know what? It's the first time I'd looked at the sort of gamut of 4K Blu-rays, and I was like, God, Steve, there's some real tat here. You're saying you own all of these? And he was like, yes. It's like, so you got the Angry Birds movie? Yes. And I got, and yeah, it's like, films that you'd have to tie me to a chair and pin my eyes open with matchsticks, and you've spent a not inconsequential sum of money on each disc.
Yeah,
and it's like, ooh. And then you had the audacity to be rude about me buying records. And as I say, let's in a year's time see whose purchases have held up value wise, and we'll rediscuss that, shall
you,
we?
You know how sad it is when you're sitting there doing the maths as Steve's picking stuff up, and you're thinking, you know, if you do the, if that's like $30 plus the tax added on to, so let's say $40 once you add the tax on. Now that's 30 odd quid for a disc. It's cheaper. You're cheaper buying them in the UK and importing them.
That's actually true.
That's what was sad. That's what was sad for me, Steve, seeing you wasting your money like that. You need help. You need help, mate.
We're going to stage an intervention.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll get the Rock to stage that intervention. I think he's the only one person that you'd listen to, isn't he?
Do you want to know what's coming out on Ultra HD Blu-ray?
Yeah, go on, Steve.
Okay, 14th of February, a couple of interesting titles coming out, actually. The Arrival, which I'm definitely getting because that's an awesome film.
Awesome.
And also, and this is interesting, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, which is the new Ang Lee movie that he shot in 3D, in 4K, and at 120 frames a second. Now, the Ultra HD Blu-ray is coming out, not 3D, it's 2D, but it's going to be at 60 frames a second. So this could be an interesting experiment in terms of what it's going to look like.
I think we know what it's going to look like.
Crap. It's going to look like a video. But I'll get it and check it out anyway. We'll see. Hacksaw Ridge, that's the new Mel Gibson directed war film, about a true story about a conscientious objector. That's apparently the most brutal conscientious objector film you're ever likely to see, which figures with Mel Gibson. Comes out on 21st of February. And also announced for 28th of March is, and The Rock's to blame here to a certain degree, we've got Fast and the Furious 6 and Furious 7 both coming out on Ultra HD Blu-ray before the release of Fate of the Furious at the cinema.
Okay, so that wraps up all the discs and the films coming out at the cinema. So I guess just to wrap up very quickly, we can look forward to that are coming up in 2017. And for myself, there's only two that stand out at the minute, and that's obviously the next Star Wars Episode 8. There's less than 300 days now, isn't there, till that comes out? Or we're getting close to that. And the other one is Trainspotting 2, which is out at the end of this month. So for someone with an unlimited card, I'm struggling to fill the year in at the minute.
Well, yeah, I can't help you with that. You spent the money, you're an adult. I mean, are we supposed to do your purchasing decisions?
Yeah, well, I mean, well, you're pushing me towards a Mustang.
I think I need to be more specific. I'm just pushing you away from an Audi. What you end up in other than that is of less concern. But you enjoyed yourself yesterday, you said so yourself. You know.
Yeah, there's something about that. There's something about a car that, you know, when you go round and round about, you're not sure if it's going to kill you or not. It's just, it adds to the excitement.
What's the point in living if you can't feel alive?
Yeah.
I think, Phil, you will be using it more than twice because I suspect you'll go and see Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
Oh, Guardians of the Galaxy, yeah. Yeah. I will go and see that. So that's at least three times it's going to get used in the next year.
We've also got... personally, there's quite... I'm looking forward to Guardians of the Galaxy. I'm looking forward to Star Wars, obviously. Trainspotting 2, definitely. I'm looking forward to the Spider-Man movie, Homecoming, which is the one that's been made by Marvel for Sony. And also we've got Thor Ragnarok coming out towards the end of the year, which I'm looking forward to. On the John Wick 2, yeah, that should be cracking. and also, since you mentioned it, John Wick is coming out on Ultra HD Blu-ray on the 14th of February as well, and you can get it for less than £15 on WOW HD, so pick it up. It's a fantastic film.
But you see, Steve, is it going to be that big an upgrade? Because I've already got the Blu-ray and it's already got the Dolby Atmos soundtrack and it already looks and sounds great. So
no, it won't be a massive upgrade, no.
Yeah, exactly so.
But if you don't have it already, get it. I tell you what I'm looking forward to coming up, going forward. We've got... I've forgotten what it is now. You interrupted me and broke my train of thought.
It's that memorable, people.
Yeah, it's that good. Someone else talk for a bit because I can't remember.
That's a sign of old age.
Nothing. I'm still not going to the actual physical cinema with all those other people. It's just ghastly. I can look forward to a film, and I'm sure that I'll get bullied into going to Star Wars in the cinema. But meh, you know.
Yeah, but that's normally a buffer treat for you, though, isn't it?
Something like that. Yeah.
You'll go and see Fate of the Furious, though, won't you? Surely.
I don't know. I just find the cinema ghastly. If I could have the screen to myself, that would be fine. But
which
it's all the other people.
Phil and I have got that.
Well, yes, okay. Well, that's not the case in Milton Keynes. There's all sorts of other people there, and they're mostly horrendous. And, you know, it's just most unappealing.
Well, what you should do, Ed, is build a home theatre in your own home.
There you go.
Well, again, I take that on board, but I'd probably be having to significantly repurpose a room that I use for quite significant activities at the moment. But, you know, yeah, all right. See how it goes. How much do I have to spend before I get the ability to get the release thing at the release date? It's about $150,000 plus, isn't it?
Yeah, you don't have to go that far. You got a garage, haven't you?
Nope.
Oh, what a shame.
No, I live 40 miles from London, remember? Think things are quite pricey around here. I'm quite pleased with the amount of space I've managed to get.
You just have to build an extension out the back.
What? Past the conservatory.
Yeah.
All right. I might try and dig an underground bunker. That's much more my thing.
Oh, no. Basements
are perfect for home cinemas.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. And just basically rig a tarp with a painting of my garden over the fence line and then just start digging so people can't see what you're up to. Brilliant.
Full cool. I remember what I was going to say. The Blade Runner sequel. I'm looking forward to that.
Thanks for that.
I don't know. It's been a long time.
Yeah.
Is anyone off to see, just out of sadistic interest, is anyone off to see La La Land?
Yes.
My wife.
Yeah. I'm gonna go and see it.
I, honest to God, there are terrible things I would rather do than go and see that film.
Snap. Looks awful.
Yeah, well, some of us have got an unlimited card that we need to use.
Yes.
I'm not going to lose money on this one.
Were you behind or ahead last year? I can't work out.
I'm slightly ahead, thanks to Star Wars and Sully.
Well,
have you watched Sully yet?
No, I haven't watched it yet. I was going to do that tomorrow night.
I've listened to all the records I bought, so I'm doing better than you.
I was going to say that really was quite an interesting record store.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I could really do something like that a bit closer to me. You know, 5,000 miles is a bit of a slep.
Well, it may become an annual pilgrimage like we do to Fry's every year.
And
I've yet to spend any money in Fry's. I'm really proud of that. It's 10 years.
I wish I could say the same.
Well, I spent money in Fry's. As I say, encountering Peace is the Mission by Major Lazer in a Nevada Fry's. It's like encountering an incredibly rare and, you know, quite esoteric country and western album in Birmingham. I was really impressed with that.
Oh, now you've mentioned it now. The Coyote, 102.7.
Did you see my message?
I did. I'm sure you can get it online somewhere.
You can, but it's 56 kbps. It's like listening to it down the phone. It's right. Not the same. I was basically disappointed.
That's a real shame that we can't listen to, you know, the dulcet tones of country and western.
And Mad Dog. Yes. But we will have the memories.
At least we managed to establish what the perfect country western song would contain.
We did, but it's not family friendly, so you should.
No, it's not.
All right, then. I think we have outstayed our welcome once again.
As usual.
And the podcast will be back to normal next week. So thank you very much for listening to this bumper edition. That's two bumper editions you've had back to back, before Christmas and after Christmas. Like I say, we're back to normal next week. Do tune in. My thanks to Steve Withers.
I told you to sit on it, Tonto.
Mark Hodgkinson.
You're making a science out of coincidence.
Ed Selly.
Yeah, I love that sexy talk.
And Mark Botwright.
Is anyone else alive?
Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, bookmark AV Forums for latest reviews, news and video, and of course, leave us those 5-star ratings on iTunes, only if you enjoyed the show, but do leave them. It helps us climb up the charts and find new listeners. I'm Phil Hinton, thank you very much for listening, and like I say, we'll see you again next week.